Two decades and still spinning. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Today we celebrate 20 years on air, and we also look forward, including what's ahead in the fight against ISIS in Iraq.
I think everyone should understand that if they want to get rid of ISIS, they have to help the local Sunnis do it.
Plus, a German Jewish historian says it's time to publish Mein Kampf again.
There's not the slightest point to suppressing access to a book that anybody can call up on their computer.
And the granddaughter of a Hiroshima survivor marries a U.S. serviceman.
When I moved to America, I feel so guilty. I just didn't want to talk to grandma. So guilty.
Those stories today on The World. And this New Year's Day, we're celebrating more than the start of a new year here in our newsroom. We're also marking 20 years since this.
This is The World. I'm Tony Khan in Boston.
And I'm Eddie Mayer in London. There's been a lot of looking back in recent days, but today, New Year's Day, our first day on the air, we thought we'd look forward to find out what the world, in both senses of the word, has in store for 1996.
Yep, the very first edition of the show, January 1st, 1996. I have not done the math, but that's somewhere around 5,200 shows. And change? Yeah, a lot. 20 years ago, we had this story on The World, courtesy of Milton and Cozy in Johannesburg.
1996 will also be the year where people expect that the new constitution will replace President Nelson Mandela as the glue holding this country together.
When Mandela died just a little over 2 years ago, we were reminded again of how he was the glue that held South Africa together. Listening back to that first show on January 1st, 96, I was also reminded how some stories have grown in relevance over the past 20 years. Here's presenter Eddie Mayer speaking on day one with our first correspondent in India, Sunita Thakur.
Sunita, is it an exciting country to cover, to be a reporter in?
There's no question. One of the things that is particularly exciting, I think, in India for the time being, and is a subject very close to my own heart, is women. Women have become very much the sort of the centerpiece of a great deal of development.
Well, as I found out on my own first trip to India 4 months ago, women are still the centerpiece, though perhaps not for the right reasons. India's women are still trying to find equality with men on so many levels. And consider this. On that first edition of The World 20 years ago, we asked our listeners, you, to write us actual letters if they wanted to give us any feedback. And then presenter Tony Khan offered this hopeful note.
We'll also be connected pretty soon, our hope is, with the Internet.
Wow. The Internet. I barely knew what it was in 96, having only recently purchased my first 14.4 dial-up modem. I'm sure you remember yours and its annoying screech. And in the 2 decades since The World first went on air, all that has changed. Feel free to tweet that if you want. Okay, let's get back up to speed in the present now. One city that had a tense and worrying New Year's Eve was Munich in Germany. Police evacuated two major railway stations there last night. German authorities say they received information that suicide bombers with links to ISIS were preparing an attack. No attack took place, but security remains high throughout Europe. My colleague Gordon Carrera is in London. He's the BBC security correspondent, and he's been keeping an eye on what's happening in Germany.
So it appears that a few days ago, the German authorities got intelligence from one partner, another country's intelligence service, saying that there was an attack that might be coming. And then last night, just a few hours before midnight, they got a second source of information from another country. We know one of them was France, that suggested that fitted in very closely to that first source and was very detailed. So mentioned these two specific train stations in Munich, even gave the name of some of the supposed suicide bombers who were going to carry out the attack. And it was the fact that it was intelligence from two countries and that it was so specific, which German authorities say meant they felt they had to act, even though now they're in the process of trying to corroborate it, look into it. They don't even know if those names are real names, let alone whether those individuals really are in Munich or even in Germany. But they say they felt that under that kind of time pressure last night, they just had to act and to shut those rail stations.
And Munich was not the only city in Europe that altered first night plans because of terrorism concerns. Brussels also canceled its annual New Year's event. What do you think all this says about the threat right now?
Well, there's no doubt Europe was on edge over Christmas and New Year. There were arrests in Ankara of people supposedly with suicide belts. There were arrests in Belgium and talk about a New Year plot then. You had Paris cancelling its fireworks as well as Brussels. And so certainly there was an edginess to Europe at this time. Now, that's just because of the increased threat on one level from so-called IS, ISIS, Daesh, whatever people in different places call them. And that threat, both from very organised, sophisticated attacks like the Paris attacks, as well as so-called self-starters who might just have a knife and try and do something. I think also, though, we are seeing more information sharing in Europe. And that also means that maybe perhaps more of these tip-offs are being shared between countries. And that's then in turn leading to this dilemma. How far do you act on them every time? What's your risk assessment? Right. When do you choose to shut down a rail station, or when do you choose to close your fireworks or not? And I think we're going to see more of those kind of time-pressured decisions coming up for European security forces, I think, in the coming months around high-profile events particularly, but all the time generally.
No doubt there's more intel sharing now, but is there also a sense with intelligence failures on two major attacks, Charlie Hebdo and the November 13th attacks in Paris, that officials are almost jumping at any warning?
I think they are nervous. I think the Paris attacks were significant for Europe because they showed the problems in information sharing. They showed that basically jihadist people planning attacks could move pretty freely across European borders, especially if they had, as many of the attackers did, European passports. But at the same time, the information required to stop them wasn't flowing across the borders nearly so easily. And so I think that's caused a lot of concern in Europe about that ability to travel, to plan attacks, to move over land as you can, or by flights from Syria and Iraq into Europe and to carry out attacks. And so I think that has led to more information sharing, certainly, and more sharing of tip-offs, and to this question about how you try and deal with that. Do you have to impose stronger border controls? Does it mean more centralization of intelligence and information sharing and watch lists? And I think Europe is currently going through a period of struggling how to deal with that, particularly a challenge when it comes to some of the smaller countries. Countries like France, Britain and Germany have got pretty big intelligence services. But one of the things, again, from Paris was that the attacks were planned from Belgium, neighbouring France, much weaker security service, and the ability of jihadists to exploit those kind of weak spots, if you like, in Europe and the smaller countries and the less able security services is certainly one of the issues. So it's both national intelligence failures sometimes, but also international and transnational ones as well, which will be worrying officials and which is certainly making them a bit more jumpy and edgy at the moment.
My colleague with the BBC, Gordon Carrera, their security correspondent. Always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now to another big news story we've been following all week, the defeat of ISIS in Ramadi in Iraq. For months, the extremists had been in control of the city, the capital of Iraq's Anbar province. But this week, the Iraqi army managed to push them out. The key to this military victory appears to be political. The population of Anbar is predominantly Sunni Muslim, and according to our friend Ayub Nouri, editor of the Kurdish news service Rudaw, the Iraqi army succeeded in this case because it told its Shiite militia allies to stay home.
People in Ramadi and in the Sunni areas of Iraq, they said there is no way we would allow an army that's accompanied by Shiite militia to come into our areas, because they had seen what those militiamen had done in terms of killings, executions, and destruction in other Sunni towns. So that's why the army came to a standstill on the outskirts of Ramadi. And in the end, they had some kind of agreement. Some numbers say 30,000 Sunni tribal men took up arms themselves, and they were the ones to lead the Iraqi army into Ramadi. So basically, it was a Sunni fight against ISIS with the help of the Iraqi ground troops and American airstrikes.
Now, the narrative has gone that the Sunnis of Anbar are mostly pro-ISIS, or at least anti-Baghdad. How surprised are you that this strategy worked?
I think that narrative is not correct, because the Sunnis of Ramadi and Fallujah and other parts of Iraq, they are not necessarily with ISIS. Mm. I think most of them do not agree with ISIS ideologically or as a political group or Islamic Caliphate. But why they accepted ISIS in Ramadi or Mosul or areas, or why at least they allowed ISIS to come so easily, was out of resentment and years of persecution that they had suffered under the Iraqi government. So they didn't like ISIS, but they preferred ISIS, who was a Sunni group who they felt safe with, to the Iraqi army, who they didn't really trust. That was the whole problem, was the issue of trust, but whether you pick ISIS or the Iraqi army, who was infiltrated by Shiite militia.
So if this can happen in Ramadi, can it happen in Fallujah or Mosul, that Sunnis can turn against ISIS?
Yes, I think it's possible, and I believe it's the only solution, because the areas we are talking about, I've been to all of those areas, Mosul, Fallujah, Ramadi, and I know people from those areas. They are capable of taking out ISIS very quickly, within a matter of days or weeks, let's say, as they did with the Al-Qaeda in 2007 and 8. So I think everyone should understand, the Americans, the outside world, and the Iraqi government, that if they want to get rid of ISIS, they have to help the local Sunnis do it. But the issue here is not only having Sunni tribes kicking out ISIS. The issue is that what is next for them, or what is in it for them? Because they did it once, they were betrayed by the central government, and that's why it took several months to retake Ramadi, because they said, we could take out ISIS, the Iraqi army will come in the next day and fight us. So I think everyone should allow the Sunnis to basically run their own affairs and make sure the Iraqi army or the Iraqi government is not going in there a few months from now and ruin it once again.
Right. And there's also a learning moment back in 2007, because the Americans did something very similar back then, enlisting Sunni tribes to defeat al-Qaeda in Anbar. In the interim, how did Baghdad manage to alienate these Sunni tribes after the Americans left?
That's a very good point. That's why all hell broke loose, or let's say everything went downhill from 2011 until now, because the Americans convinced the Sunnis of Anbar to kick out the Al-Qaeda, which they did. And as soon as the Americans withdrew at the end of 2011, the Iraqi government under Maliki went in and arrested people and killed dozens of people, saying, you are all terrorists, you are all with the Al-Qaeda. And then ISIS took advantage of this grievance and came in, and we saw overnight how it took over Iraq's Sunni heartland. So what is important is to make sure the current Iraqi government is not going to alienate once again the people who are fighting ISIS today.
Yes. Yeah, so what assurances do the Sunnis have from the Iraqi government this time?
I was speaking to someone from Fallujah a few days ago, and he said that local tribes and tribal leaders in Fallujah and Anbar have some sense that they are going to have an autonomous Sunni region, as we have in the north of Iraq. So what he literally said is that some Sunni autonomous Sunni region is on the horizon. So that would be the only insurance, I think. Because if they know that they will kick out ISIS and they have to hand everything back to the Iraqi government, they wouldn't have done it in the first place.
All right. So, Ayub, if this can happen in Fallujah and Mosul, does that mean that ISIS is on its way out, at least in Iraq?
Yes. And if they lose Iraq, then it will automatically be weakened in Syria, too.
Ayub Nouri with the Kurdish News Service Rudal, speaking with us from Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. Thank you very much, Ayub. Always good to speak.
Thank you. You are welcome.
Coming up on the show, the big end of 2015 holiday present you may not have heard about, solar panels. That's later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on this New Year's Day. Coming up, Adolf Hitler's other book, but first a few other stories that caught our attention today. Let's start with what the new year looked like on the often volatile Korean Peninsula. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un gave his annual New Year's address on state TV. He said North Korea will continue to actively try to improve relations with South Korea. Kim also had this warning. If invaders and agitators trouble us even a little bit, Kim said, we will absolutely not accept it. Kim then promised that North Korea will firmly respond in the manner of a ruthless holy war for justice and unification. For her part, South Korean leader Park Geun-hye promised to sternly deal with any North Korean provocations. But she also said South Korea will always leave its door open for talks with the North. In India, the first day of 2016 brings new environmental regulations in Delhi. Today, the Indian capital started a trial that's designed to keep more than a million cars off the streets. For 2 weeks, even an odd-numbered license plates will only be allowed on the roads on alternate days. Officials hope the measure will help clean up one of the smoggiest cities in the world. Delhi residents are divided. Some say it's about time. Others say it won't help because the measure doesn't include stinky two-wheeled scooters. Anumita Roy Chowdhury is with the Indian lobbying group, the Center for Science and Development.
Two-wheelers, because of their sheer numbers, are also a major contributor to pollution in the city. And therefore, if you are letting them off, then the whole effectiveness of the program will be compromised.
And in Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is already making headlines just one day into the new year. During an interview, Erdogan cited Hitler's Germany as one example of an effective presidential system. Turkish government officials said his remarks were taken out of context, but that might not placate Erdogan's critics, who fear the president's plans to boost the powers of his own office. And there's actually one more reason why Adolf Hitler is in the news on this January 1st. Turns out the copyright to his infamous book, Mein Kampf, expired at midnight last night. The German state of Bavaria used to own the rights. Now the book is in the public domain. Mein Kampf was not the only book Hitler wrote, though. Daniel Gross has a story of the German-Jewish historian who found Hitler's second book.
Gerhard Weinberg witnessed the run-up to World War II, first as a boy in Nazi Germany, then in an English boarding school.
The Germans dropped a big bomb on it, which fortunately did not explode or I wouldn't be here. We felt very lucky, especially after we learned how big this bomb was.
It wasn't the only time he was lucky. Weinberg was born in 1928. His parents were German and Jewish. When Hitler came to power in the early 1930s, Weinberg hardly knew what Nazi meant. He just knew some places were off limits.
You would see signs at restaurants and movie houses and whatnot, Jews not admitted.
When Weinberg started school, life got even more uncomfortable.
Getting beaten up in school is not a pleasant experience. I would have terrible nosebleeds, and on the way home from school would hide out somewhere until it stopped because I didn't want to upset my mother. And kids at school would say to each other, you better behave or you go to the KZ, you go to the concentration camp.
After Kristallnacht in November 1938, Weinberg and his siblings escaped to England. His father, though, was thrown in jail and nearly sent to a concentration camp. But he was lucky, too. A former employer got him released. The family was reunited in England, where they waited for a chance to immigrate to the United States.
But we had to wait for the quota numbers.
After more than a year, they were cleared to settle in Albany, New York. The war ended, and Weinberg joined the U.S. Army, which helped him become an American and a historian.
I was interested in history because of what I had seen and heard.
Which was how Weinberg the German refugee became Weinberg the researcher of Nazi Germany. Remember, this was only a decade after World War II. Piles of confiscated German documents were still sitting in an old torpedo factory in Virginia. Weinberg was asked to sort through those documents. For a young war historian, it was the perfect job. But it also brought up painful memories.
When I was working in this torpedo factory, one of the soldiers there came over to me and said, Gerhard, aren't you from Hanover? And I said, yes. And he showed me the November 1938 list from Hanover, and there was the arrest list with my father's name on it.
Around that time, Weinberg heard about a book that could revolutionize his research.
I discovered references to Hitler having dictated but not published a second book. And so I hoped that at some point it might turn up. It was also entirely possible that no copies survived. One day on my desk, I had a folder listed as a partial draft of Mein Kampf. And the moment I opened and started reading, I realized this is not a draft of Mein Kampf. This is the second book.
Hitler's writings weren't easy to read. Big surprise there. They're repetitive, grandiose, and violently anti-Semitic. But as a professional historian, Weinberg was thrilled. The second book could help reveal subtle shifts in Hitler's ideology. It proved, for example, that in 1928, Hitler was already expecting a war with the United States.
There is, in other words, an extraordinary consistency in the lunatic concepts and ideas.
Even so, Weinberg had a hard time publishing the second book. The German edition was released in 1961, but more than 40 years passed before an official English edition came out. Weinberg says American publishers were afraid to take it on. Those fears haven't gone away. A few years ago, the same German institute that published Hitler's second book announced plans to republish Hitler's first book, Mein Kampf. Initially, German lawmakers tried to block the project. One official even threatened legal action. But to Weinberg, this whole controversy seemed silly.
My own view is there's not the slightest point to suppressing access to a book that anybody can call up on their computer. And it is preferable that there should now be a properly, carefully edited edition.
The Bavarian government finally decided not to fight the new edition of Mein Kampf. It comes out this month with a hefty introduction and several thousand footnotes. Weinberg says it's about time. He knows from his own life that one way to overcome the past is to study the past. And he thinks reading Hitler's books might actually help prevent injustice in the future.
The Germans are not some separate species on Earth. Other people might someday fall for something similar. We need to be rather careful.
For The World, I'm Daniel Gross.
You can read Daniel's full profile of Gerhard Weinberg on the website of The New Yorker. You'll find a link at PRI.org. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. What makes a cynical cartoonist feel even worse? Pop music played in a supermarket.
I start feeling so misanthropic and so negative, I have to get out of there. And my wife, Aileen, she'll just say, just tune it out. But I can't. It's unbearable to me.
The kind of music R. Crumb can bear ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Happy New Year and happy 20 years to us. In 1996, climate change was a problem, still is a problem, but nearly 200 countries have now committed themselves to lowering their emissions of greenhouse gases. That's the gist of the climate deal reached in Paris last month. Now nations actually have to achieve their targets. Investing in more renewable energy is a start, and here in the U.S., solar got a big holiday gift from Congress, a four-year extension of the tax credit for new solar panels. For every dollar solar manufacturers spend, the government will give them 30 cents back. You and I can get the same deal for putting panels on our roofs. The World's Jason Margolis explored all of this.
I looked into putting solar panels on my roof. A company pulled up an aerial shot of my home on Google Earth and minutes later said, no dice. A large tree is blocking out the sunlight. Henry Lee at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government says many of us in dense urban areas are finding it hard to go solar.
Just go out one day and walk around Boston and take a look at how many roofs have a large amount of space facing south. Not many.
That doesn't mean we can't own solar panels, though. They just can't be on our roofs. They can be in places like this muddy field in the Massachusetts town of Fairhaven near Cape Cod. Workers are putting up thousands of solar panels here.
You got a sunny day today.
Yeah, it's great. Perfect. And it's like you see the sun is very much directed right down on these panels.
Mark Sylvia is a managing director at Blue Wave Capital, a Boston-based company that invests in so-called community solar projects. They find customers who want to put up solar panels but can't. This field will service about 100 customers.
So the individual actually will be able to drive by the site and say, I'm getting my power locally from this facility. I'm actually benefiting locally from this.
Here's how this all works, the basics. You now own a few solar panels in this field. They pump electrons into the electricity grid. Due to federal tax rebates and incentives from the state of Massachusetts, your solar electrons are cheap. So your utility says, thanks for the electrons, here's a discount.
So if you enter into an agreement for community solar, that'll enable you to reduce your energy cost by 10%.
So if my bill is $100, now I'll be paying $90.
Correct.
Here's another nice thing about community solar. There's no upfront capital cost. You don't have to plunk down $10,000 or $20,000 to install panels on your roof. Your long-term savings may be lower, but you don't have to come up with that big chunk of money right now. In order to make the community solar business model work, though, you have to commit to it.
It's a 20-year contract.
So as a commitment-phobic person, that scares me. Why should I not be scared, though?
Well, because it's a 20-year contract that commits you to reducing your electricity bill on an annual basis.
Other companies lock in a guaranteed rate for 20 years. The rate I was quoted looked like a sweet deal today, but costs of solar panels have fallen substantially in the past few years, and I don't want to be the sucker who locks in too early. Henry Lee at Harvard says it's fair to harbor some reservations.
I think that solar costs are going to continue to go down, maybe not as dramatically as they have in the last few years, but they're going to continue to come down, and as a result, I would be somewhat hesitant to enter into such a deal right now.
On the other hand, every month I wait, I'm paying more on my electricity bill, and I'm not helping the environment. These are questions I have the luxury to grapple with here in Boston, but they're not the kind of calculations that most people are making in the developing world. They just want reliable energy. It's cheaper to build a bunch of panels at once in a field as opposed to going roof to roof, so I asked Corey Honeyman if community solar could have benefits in poorer countries. He's an analyst with GTM Research in Boston, a firm that covers the solar industry.
Yeah, I think that community solar can, in theory, touch upon the broader best practices in economic development, right? I think when you have a community solar project in an emerging economy, you get buy-in from the broader community to make sure that project is a success, not just from the installation phase, but through the project's entire life cycle.
Honeyman adds, the business model for community solar remains a work in progress, and the U.S. tax credit extension won't help much in the developing world. The credit focuses on installation of solar in the U.S., not overseas. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
This past summer marks 70 years since the end of World War II. Japan surrendered not long after the U.S. dropped two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The two Japanese cities were devastated. Most of the dead were civilians. Over the years, The World's Patrick Cox has interviewed some of the survivors and their families. Last summer, he returned to Hiroshima and spoke with them again. Among them was a woman whose family history has taken an unusual turn. Here's Patrick's report, which first aired last August.
I first met Sueko Hada 10 years ago, just before the 60th anniversary of Hiroshima. She told me her story then, what happened to her on the morning of August 6, 1945, about the flash of light, the huge explosion, and how, in an instant, the rest of her family ceased to exist. Mother, father, four sisters, all except for her, a 7-year-old child. Hadar was at home with her sisters that morning. The family home collapsed, leaving them trapped.
Eventually, I managed to claw my way out from under the rubble. By now, our house was on fire and the cries of my sisters were getting fainter. I left to look for help. When I went outside, I saw that everything had totally changed. Although it had been a beautiful morning, it looked like twilight now. Everyone was injured, badly injured. No one was helping other people. They just looked after themselves. I myself was bleeding from a neck wound. There was blood all over the white clothes I was wearing. I wanted to return to the house, but I got lost. The landscape had totally changed. I didn't know which way to go. The only thing I could do was to follow the other injured people. Still to this day, my sisters' voices haunt me. I can hear them saying, "Please, call for help." That's the most painful thing. That I ran away from my sisters. I've felt guilty about this since that day. I'll feel guilty as long as I live. I'll never be happy.
Hada told me more, much more, about other terrible things that befell her or that she witnessed in the hours, days, and years after the blast. At times, she went into graphic detail of deaths that she witnessed, from burns, from radiation sickness, quick deaths, slow deaths. She also spoke of her unhappy upbringing by relatives who scolded her when she cried, telling her she was the lucky one to have survived. And listening to Hadar that day 10 years ago were her family members, her daughter and two granddaughters. Earlier this summer in Hiroshima, I met them again, minus one of the granddaughters. More about her later. In the intervening decade, Hadar has become used to telling her story publicly, usually on a stage in front of hundreds of people. Like many Hiroshima survivors, she has in her later years broken her silence, her mission to bear witness. Even though she's told her story scores of times, she can still be tripped up.
Sometimes a memory comes to me out of the blue, right while I'm telling my story and I catch my breath. Oh, that happened, I tell myself. And I make a note of it so I can include it next time I speak.
4 years ago, Hadar visited the United States and spoke to audiences in Washington, Boston, and elsewhere.
Americans listened intently to what I had to say. One time, a young person approached me saying, "I'm sorry," and gave me a hug. I was very moved. I thought, these Americans were good people, and it was only the war that made our nations fight each other.
It's never easy for Hadar to tell her story, whether to Americans or Japanese, but speaking to strangers is manageable. It's a million miles from the intimacy of a one-on-one conversation with a family member.
When I make a public speech, I just tell my story as it happened and say how I felt. But with my family, I really, really don't want the kids to hear all the gruesome details. It was such a terrible experience. So to them, I end up telling an edited version of the story. When my daughter and I talk about it, we tend to be too shy to talk frankly. It's only in the last year or two that she started asking questions about my experience.
Hadar says that Hiroshima's authorities are trying to recruit more so-called memory keepers, second and third generation survivors, who'll tell the story of their older relative once the relative has died. With her own daughter sitting just a few feet away, Hadar tells me how torn she is about this. She desperately wants her daughter to become a memory keeper, and at the same time, she wants to shield her from the pain that she herself has suffered. This is when things get a bit much. Hadar is surrounded by a loving, supportive family, something that she lacked for so long. I ask her about the granddaughter who isn't in the room, Yuko. This is what happened to her. Not long after I first met the family 10 years ago, Yuko went to a party thrown by a friend of hers, a friend who was married to an American. There's a Marine Air Corps station close to Hiroshima. At the party, Yuko met a U.S. Marine. They dated, they got married, and after a few years, they moved to the United States.
At first I thought, why does it have to be an American guy? But now I think it's a good thing. I'm hoping that Yuko will become a bridge between Japan and the U.S. She's not a very social type, but she's trying so hard to communicate with Americans and to fit in. I've seen a video of her trying to do that at a party. It makes me think that one day I could go to one of those parties at her house and speak to the people there as the grandmother of Yuko. Instead of making a speech to strangers from a stage, I could just tell my story to them.
When I moved to America, I feel so guilty, so guilty. I just didn't want to talk to grandma. So guilty.
I went to visit Yuko in Colorado Springs, where she now lives. She talks regularly with her grandmother.
Her character and my character is exactly the same. She thinks that way, I think that way, same way. Sometimes good, sometimes not good. I'm mini grandma.
Yuko was close to her grandfather, too. He was still alive when she and her American boyfriend, Nick, decided to get married. She was worried about telling her grandfather. He was a bit of a throwback. During World War II, he trained as a kamikaze pilot.
he hates America. He doesn't want to do anything American things too, but we have to visit him.
When Yuko and Nick did visit and tell him of their plans, it went okay. They avoided serious subjects and kept things jokey. That's how her husband is, Yuko says, a joker, which, given the circumstances, isn't bad. But she says he's reluctant to talk, even with her, about her grandmother's story.
So he knows the story, but he never comment anything. He tried to be cool. He doesn't speak up. I would love to know what he thinks about something inside.
Not surprisingly, he didn't want to talk with me either. Yuko Arnold, that's her name now, she says she's very happy with Nick. They have two young children. She says in time she'll tell them all about their great-grandmother and the atomic bomb. She'll have to, she says, because they won't learn much about it in American schools. That episode of history, the world's first nuclear strike, does come up in conversations that Yuko has with American friends, but only when they ask her where in Japan she's from.
Like, oh, I came from Hiroshima. Everybody said, oh, atomic bomb. That's it. Yeah, that's it. I was like, okay. That's it. But if I speak up to talk to American, they just don't care. Or I don't know what they're feeling, but it's just not point to talking because they don't want to dig in that history.
Yuko Arnold has little choice but to dig into history. It's part of her family history, and she knows that she and her grandmother encourage each other to speak up when it feels easier to say nothing.
It's really harder to speak up about my grandma's story, but one day, hopefully I can speak up one day, because I'm here.
The granddaughter of an atomic bomb survivor living in America. Japan is far away, but it feels a bit closer in the era of Skype and FaceTime, which is just as well, because family means everything to both granddaughter and grandmother. As well as the family they share, Yuko has her American family, and Sueko Hada has the memory of her first family, the family that vanished in 1945. Just recently, she started dreaming of her father for the first time.
I was a daddy's girl 70 years ago. My father would take me everywhere. And it was that memory of him that showed up in my dream. He hugged me, and I said to him, oh, Daddy, I've been looking for you. Where were you? And finally, I could cry. In his arms. I had such a very big cry. And then I woke up crying. But I was full of joy, too.
Hada wonders why her father has appeared to her after all these years. Did he want to tell her something? Friends say that maybe he's cheering her on because he knows how hard it's been for her to speak publicly, to convey to other people what it was like to live through such an ordeal. Hadar thinks maybe that's what it is. What she knows for sure, though, is that this recurring dream is making her happy. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
We've got photos of Sueko Hada and her family. You can also hear Patrick's profile of her from 10 years ago, in which she describes the bomb and its aftermath, and her life growing up as an orphan. That plus other Hiroshima stories are at pri.org/Hiroshima. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We've made a lot of radio since we first hit the airwaves 20 years ago and gone to lots of places. But there's one trip I took that I like to revisit about once a year. I went to see R. Crumb, the underground comic book artist and illustrator. He's obsessive, he says so himself, when it comes to collecting 78 RPM shellac recordings. In 2003, he put out a compilation of some really great songs by women singers from around the globe. We're talking songs from the 1920s and 30s. I got in touch with Crumb, and eventually he agreed to meet me at his little medieval stone house in the south of France.
We're sitting in my library here, and along the walls I have shelves of obscene amounts of old 78s.
And it was in that library that Crumb told me about some of the singers he'd discovered while collecting 78s. Like these women from Congo, recorded by French academics, and about the way commercial record companies did business in Africa or Asia or South America at the time.
The commercial company would go and say, who are the most respected and favored musicians in this area? Like when there's a party or a gathering, who do they want to get for the entertainment, you know, and that's who they'd record. So that musically, that's usually stronger. It's usually stronger.
And the Vietnamese side that you have by Co Ba Tin Cam Chien, that was on Columbia. What was Columbia doing in Saigon in 1930?
Right. Well, these record companies, they were quite global in their conception of themselves at that time, and they loaded hundreds and hundreds of pounds of heavy equipment on some kind of a truck or something and travel to these places under arduous circumstances and then try and set up a music business, basically.
The templates for 78 Shellac Records was wax. Were these record companies like traveling around with like barrels of wax?
They had to keep the stuff packed, the wax masters packed in dry ice. There's still like letters in the files of some of these big companies in England and places like that of these guys from the 20s and 30s complaining about the hard time they're having setting up to do these recordings. It was incredible. You definitely have to be in a certain kind of special mood to sit down and want to listen to something like that. That takes an effort. And yet, if you are in that mood and willing to do that, it's very rewarding, you know, because you enter into a culture that's so different and you pick up something from it that's very special and unique to that time and place. From listening to old music of this kind, lower class music from the old days, all modern popular music to me has pretensions in it of contrived false emotions, which I'm so spoiled by this old stuff, I cannot tolerate it. You know, if I'm in a supermarket and there's some really obnoxious popular music playing, that to me it becomes almost unbearable. I start feeling so misanthropic and so negative, I have to get out of there. And my wife, Aileen, she'll just say, just tune it out. But I can't. I can't. It's unbearable to me.
What do you think the technology did to the culture by committing it to a record?
It's like a virgin losing her virginity. It changes everything forever. Like you can hear records that are made the first time some musicians ever recorded. You can hear their totally unself-conscious. Then you can hear their second recording session. They've heard their first records. They've experienced the response to their first records, and that you can see the change. It's like seeing your reflection in a mirror for the first time, you know? Some of these people I had a really hard time getting any information about. This Miss Neelam Bai, this Hindu one that I've got on here, I managed to find out something about the context she sang in from this secretary of the Indian Record Collecting Society in Bombay. And to my ear, this Neelam Bai sounded like some kind of wild, rural village music. But he said, in fact, what she's singing, the contents of the song, the words which are in Hindi, I can't understand them, Hindustani. And he said she was probably employed in the boudoir of wealthy males who are courting some, courtesan-type woman, you know. And her role is to flatter the male sexual ego. So he said the words are... He wrote down the words for me. It's the most disgusting, unctuous, obsequious flattering of male sexual prowess you'd ever heard. It's really almost sickeningly, you know. The music, the voice is so wild-sounding, it's hard to imagine it in a romantic setting where she's shouting in this intense way. But, yeah, it's a different culture, different time. It's amazing.
I mean, given the efforts that these record companies made to record these people and sort of put them down to posterity, it's surprising that there isn't more information known about who these musicians were. You'd think that they would have kept some kind of biographical files on these people.
As far as I know, they didn't keep biographical files on any of these kind of rural or regional musicians at all. And even whatever record company files there were about when and where the stuff was recorded, a lot of that's also vanished. You know, you'd find some company had all this stuff till 5 years ago, including like the metal masters for the records and everything, and they just ran out of warehouse space, and some executives would say, okay, let's just toss all this stuff away.
What happens when...
when I die?
Right, Robert Crumb. What happens when you die, or what are you going to do with this? Because this is valuable, and you've been combing through the best of the best for a long time.
Well, the biggest mistake is to think as a collector that when you die, some university or some archive is going to want this stuff. That's the first mistake a lot of people make. You know, and I was recently at the Alan Lomax Archive in New York, and I did some artwork for them, and they let me take some 78s out of there for it. And it's incredible. The 78s are in a complete state of neglect there. You know, they don't have the money. They don't have, you know, they're earnest and sincere, but they don't, you know, it's Alan Lomax's 78 collection. I got some good records out of there.
Cartoonist R. Crumb speaking with me in 2004, one of the many voices you've heard on the world over the past 20 years. Our theme music, 20 years ago and still today, was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.